Good morning, everyone. You're listening to the World Teacher Program for Share International New Zealand on Planet FM 104.6. Each Friday morning, we bring you information from the teachers of the Ageless Wisdom. The purpose of our program is to introduce Maitreya, the world teacher for the Age of Aquarius. Maitreya does not come alone. He brings with him the Masters of Wisdom, a group of highly evolved teachers who work in many fields and teach us the art of living, how to work in right relationship with each other. With their inspiration, we can transform our civilization, creating justice and peace, and use the technological advances available to us. The information we present is taken from the writings of Benjamin Krem, a disciple of a Master of Wisdom, and also from teachers of the Ageless Wisdom. We include teachings from many schools of thought to demonstrate how they are working out in the world. Our articles are often inspiring. We hope to inform the public of actions taken around the globe to improve conditions for us all and to find means of addressing some of our most pressing problems.
Good morning, listeners, and welcome to our program. Today we're going to feature an article from a book called Basics, or The Basics of Esotericism, written by R. Turin, a South African author. And it's based on the Alice Bailey teachings. And the first article is called Nature and Its Kingdoms. And it was written in the Share International magazine, 1983 issue, July-August issue. And we begin. Our existence would be so much richer, more interesting and complete if a deeper perspective could be gained of the factors and influences which from day to day determine the course of our lives. Let us therefore consider some aspects of nature and see whether a general picture can be sketched of the role it plays in our lives and how some of its major components fit together and complement each other. Let us first gain some concept as to where and how nature relates to the overall picture, to the universe. In considering physical existence from man's point of view and using the earth as our point of reference, the position may be approached from two standpoints.
In the first instance, our earth could be considered as one of the planets in our solar system, each of these planets having an orbit around our central sun. Or, according to astronomers, there are innumerable such solar systems of varying sizes and characteristics. In the same way as the planets are revolving around a sun, so a number of solar systems again orbit around some central collective body or group. And this complex pattern forms another entity, which we call a constellation. A number of constellations are in turn associated together in a still bigger system, and thus it continues on and on, all bound together by energy into that one incomprehensible whole, the universe, the ultimate, in which our insignificant little planet Earth practically disappears and is representative relatively as merely a minute little atom.
The second point is that Earth can be considered as our macrocosm. From this standpoint, the Earth could, in its turn, also be viewed as one whole, a living entity, a god, a logos, or as some prefer to call it, simply nature. Actually, nature is but a synthesis or combination of all the manifested forms of life, energy that has been knit and bound together in all the various forms which are distinguished from each other by different grades of consciousness. Various degrees of limitation and consciousness can be used as a basis to classify all of nature into seven kingdoms.
It should, however, always be kept in mind that though this classification is used for the sake of clarity and convenience, no fixed dividing lines can be drawn between the individual kingdoms. They all merge and overlap, and in the end form part of one coordinated whole, with energy as the unifying medium. The kingdoms are the mineral, the vegetable, the animal, the human, and the spiritual kingdoms, plus two others which, together with the fifth or spiritual kingdom, are the divine kingdoms and are beyond the comprehension of ordinary man. And we can only classify them together as forming the kingdom of God without really understanding the meaning. The classification into kingdoms is largely based on the stage to which the consciousness of the group has developed. In the mineral kingdom, for example, consciousness seems to be totally absent or otherwise quite dormant. But there is already some reaction, for instance, to heat and cold.
In the vegetable kingdom, the first signs of sensitivity become noticeable, and although this cannot yet be classified as consciousness, it may be regarded as the first indications of an awakening awareness. In the animal kingdom, what is called instinctive consciousness is already strongly developed, but real self-consciousness, guided by mind and reason, is only found in man. As far as its physical extent is concerned, the mineral kingdom is by far the most extensive, as it embraces all of the earth's crust as well as the enclosed core, which may still be largely in a molten state. The decomposed surface, which we know as soil or earth, serves as the physical medium of support for the vegetable, animal, and human kingdoms.
To the man in the street, mineral matter is lifeless. But again, it is merely a question of relativity and point of view. All matter consists of energy, and basically all energy is life. Furthermore, an indication of this life can be found in the constant movement of the electrons around the nucleus of each atom. Another typical quality of minerals is that all of them, to a greater or lesser extent, incessantly radiate energy. This radioactivity is an indication of the hidden forces that lie concealed in minerals. They also react to heat and cold by expanding and shrinking, and this should be regarded as a form of sensitivity.
To summarize, we can therefore state that minerals do contain life. Life that is, to the large extent, rigidly bound and restricted, and demonstrating a limited sensitivity, which can perhaps be interpreted as the first indications of a slumbering consciousness. The vegetable kingdom decorates our planet. Without our plant life, the trees, grass, and flowers, with their colors and scent, the earth's surface would be bare and sterile and totally uninhabitable by animal or man as they are present constituted, as they are at present constituted. Both these latter kingdoms are directly or indirectly dependent on vegetable life. As is generally known, plants definitely have life, but as far as we are aware, this life is still unconscious.
There are, however, several plants showing signs of sensitivity, and this should really be regarded as a first awakening of a budding consciousness. There are, for instance, several kinds of flowers, of which the sunflower is a well-known example, which will keep facing the sun throughout the course of the day. Some plants will fold their leaves when the plant is touched, just as there are flowers that will not open till they have been warmed by the sun. So, in contrast, there are several species of so-called evening flowers, which only open after sunset. The vegetable kingdom obtains its life energy mainly from mineral source solutions in the soil, from moisture, constituents of the air, and sunlight. Animal and man also utilize these sources, but in addition depend largely, directly or indirectly, on vegetable matter, which is digested and from which the basic mineral elements can then be more readily assimilated than from the fundamental sources.
The animal kingdom is also characterized by a wide variety, which may vary from unicellular life to relatively complex and highly developed forms. In the case of some of the higher animals, a certain measure of consciousness is definitely noticeable, but the reasoning faculty is still lacking, and their reactions to external influences are as yet largely automatic and the result of an inborn instinctive unconsciousness rather than the product of a mind. Another interesting point of difference between an animal and a human being is the question of pain. Both animal and man are subject to physical pain. Such pain may at times become excruciating and almost impossible to bear. But in addition to this physical torture, man is also subject to emotional pain, such as qualms of conscience, remorse, and self-reproach. Although one can never make a direct comparison between the physical and the emotional, as these sensations are registered on totally different levels, emotional suffering may also become very hard to endure.
A third form of pain that only man is subject to and from which the animal is exempt might be called mental pain and is due to man's imaginative capacity. He may have suffered some unpleasant emotional or physical experience on a previous occasion, and owing to a strong and vivid imagination, he is able to relive this experience so clearly that he actually goes through it all again, even to the extent of mentally re-suffering the pain. Or there may be the fear that a similar experience could be repeated, and just this fear may provide sufficient to cause additional and long drawn-out suffering. Mental pain is therefore but an illusion of pain, but to the person subject to such glamour, the suffering experienced could be most realistic and may recur till he succeeds in overcoming this form of self-deception.
The outstanding difference between animal and man is, of course, to be found in the mental capacity or quality of the brain, in that man has the capacity to reason and has that abstract quality known as the mind, of which no further description can be given. Closely related to the mind is the soul, the possession of which has lifted man from the animal to the human kingdom. The individual soul is the intangible, immeasurable, or subjective quality which really distinguishes man from animal. Animal species exist through group souls, the units of which are drawn back into the oversoul as each animal dies. Some of the distinctive characteristics of the soul are joy and happiness, love, compassion and understanding, wisdom and intuition. And all these lead up to the most important aspect, named immortality. The human kingdom occupies the central position between the three lower or material kingdoms and the three higher or spiritual kingdoms, and therefore forms the link or bridge between these worlds. The lower kingdoms will, in the course of aeons, evolve through the human to the spiritual.
With regard to this aspect, it is interesting to note that within the human family, individuals representing every possible stage of development are to be found. At the lower end of the range, there are those who are still very close to the brute animal, with low intelligence and the self-consciousness hardly as yet awakened, who are only interested in satisfying their material and sensual needs. At the other end of the scale are those who are completely controlled by the soul and who are no longer interested in the material except as a means of service to be used on behalf of their fellow man. These individuals have then reached perfection and are ready to continue their further evolution on spiritual levels.
Between these two extremes on the human scale will be found individuals of every possible degree of development and with every possible combination of good and bad and of material and spiritual characteristics. Whether realized or not, they will, however, all have one property in common, the urge or drive towards personal improvement. In the early stages, this may be demonstrated as utter selfishness and greed for the purely material and for the satisfaction of the animal and sensual appetites and cravings. At a later stage, the emotional life will become of greater importance, and with still further development, the emphasis will fall at first on mental and finally on spiritual matters. The motives for the envisaged improvement will also change. Initially, only the personal advantages to be gained will play a role, but the stage will eventually be reached when the individual will forget about his own person and will merely regard himself as an instrument in the hands of higher entities. His striving will then be to make this instrument as effective as possible in the service of humanity and the furtherance of the divine plan.
Finally, let us consider the spiritual kingdom and its relationship with the other kingdoms. It is an interesting fact that even amongst primitive peoples there is, as a rule, a belief in the existence of some form of heaven or hereafter, although the ideas about the nature of such heaven will vary widely. On the other hand, many modern people will ridicule all such nonsense, or rather, they may loudly proclaim this negative attitude in public, but secretly entertain different ideas. They still feel somewhat uncertain, they do not have the courage of their convictions, and are afraid to express their inner feelings to their associates. The trouble is that to the man who is still completely bound by the material and who has not yet made conscious contact with his soul, it is most difficult to form any concept of the subjective or spiritual world unless he obtains an inkling of the unknown through intuitive perception.
It is only after there that has been some spiritual development or contact that the conscious awareness of the hidden world start to develop. And in the early stages, even this awareness is still very vague and something that certainly cannot be described to others in words. In practice, it really boils down to the fact that a man must first be controlled by his soul before he can form any concept of what the soul really is. Let's see. To conclude, it should be mentioned that the spiritual kingdom consists of those individuals who, after countless lives in the material world, and after having gained every possible physical experience during aeons of existence, eventually reach a stage of perfection, as a result of which they no longer need to return to a physical body for further experience. And we know them as the masters of wisdom, as they have mastered themselves.
And now for an article by one of these masters of wisdom, published in the magazine, and it's titled Evolution versus Creationism. Many people believe, or affect to believe, that this world as it stands today is not more than 5,000 years old, that man and all the creatures of the animal kingdom and the rocks of the mineral kingdom were created in a few days, fully fledged and finished in all aspects. They hold that evolution is a myth, that the Christian Bible account of creation is literally true and correct. To accept such a theory, it is necessary to close one's eyes to science in general and to the sciences of geology, anthropology, paleontology, and archaeology in particular. It is indeed true to say that there was a time when man did not walk the earth, when dinosaurs, gigantic in size, roamed and ruled instead. It is also true that, according to our reckoning, man's history is infinitely older than today's science believes. By today's reckoning, humanity is approximately 5 or 6 million years old at the most. By our science and tradition, however, early animal man had reached the point when individualization became possible and the sons of mind began their long journey of evolution. It has taken man 18.5 million years to reach the level of today. How then is it possible for intelligent, educated creationists to hold against the evidence of science what seems to be a ludicrous concept?
The answer lies in the fact that the evolutionists and the creationists are really arguing at cross purposes. Both in their limited way are right. Modern scientists looking objectively at the findings of Darwin have accumulated a wealth of evidence for the case of evolution, a long, slow development of men from animal ancestors, in particular by the development of mind. The creationists look to the Christian Bible as their guide, ignoring the fact that the Bible was written by hundreds of people over hundreds of years, that it is written in symbolic language and is meant to be symbolic rather than factual. The creationist is at pains to emphasize that man was made by God in God's own image and so owes nothing to evolution. To such, Darwin and those who follow him are missing the point about man, that he is a spiritual being of divine heritage, and if he does not always behave as God's creation, he has been corrupted by Satan. Can these two diametrically opposed views be bridged and expanded at the same time? From our point of understanding, the scientists of today, the evolutionists, are undoubtedly correct in their analysis of man's development from the animal kingdom. We owe our physical bodies to the animal kingdom. That, however, does not make us animals. Darwin and those who correctly follow his thoughts describe only the outer physical development of man, largely ignoring that we are all engaged in the development of consciousness.
And that's all we have time for. Thank you very much for listening. If you'd like more information, check out the website share-international.org or write to us at sharenz@yahoo.com. Love and blessings to you all.